Welcome to this ABC Radio National podcast. For more on other entertaining and informative programs, listen after the end for details. But right now, here's your podcast, which we hope you enjoy.
Hello and welcome to The Sports Factor here on ABC Radio National. I'm Mick O'Regan. Money makes the world go round, though of late it seems to go round the way water goes round the sink on the way to the plug hole. And sport is part of the money business, big time. As the Fairfax sports writer Jacqueline Magnay noted yesterday, we're in a crisis, and if professional sports people haven't realised it yet, they're going to get a pay cut. Basically, money's too tight to mention, and it's affecting sporting bodies and teams around the world. Now, at the big end of sport and sponsorship, the pharmaceutical giant Johnson & Johnson has decided to cut its sponsorship of the International Olympic Committee. And in fact, Britain's Olympics minister, Tessa Jowell, acknowledged that if the extent of the financial crisis had been known earlier, London wouldn't have been so keen to bid for the 2012 Games. All of which makes the decision of our federal government to boost the funding of the Australian Sports Commission by over $12.5 million very newsworthy. The man currently in charge of the ASC, Brent Espeland, joins me now. Welcome to The Sports Factor.
Thanks very much.
Brent Espeland, given that money for sport seems to be pretty tight all around the world, I should begin by asking, what's your secret?
Well, this particular $12.6 million boost from the Australian government, it really is a timing issue, in that you'd be aware that the government has commissioned an independent review of sport, and that's obviously still coming through. So to provide some certainty to the sports sector and sporting organisations, there's been a $12.6 million boost. But as I said, very, very much looking towards the independent review headed up by David Crawford in terms of what will be the long-term shape of the Australian sporting system.
And we might come to that briefly at the end of this conversation, but just in terms of what this money means in practical terms, is it about continuity of coaching staff or programs? Does it allow you to develop existing programs?
It's got three essential components. There's $8.1 million, roughly $4 million in two sort of trenches going to the national sporting organisations. The first roughly $4 million is about supplementation, and that will allow them, particularly for the period coming up, for, just as you suggest, the employment of coaches and the like. So it's broadly in support of their high performance programs and pathways. The second $4 million is really to provide for international competition, because in the end you can sort of do the perfect thing from a training point of view, but you need that that high level of international competition, and also obviously in terms of, that's where your measure of success comes in terms of your international endeavours. So the costs of international travel have been going up considerably for sporting organisations, and it's not just the fares, so to speak, the pricing structure, it's also the need to travel. We have a tyranny of distance, which has been remarked on before in terms of travelling to the centre of most of the sports international competition, which is in North America and Europe. Basically, the need to travel in terms of qualification for world championships and ultimately for the Olympics and Paralympics, both summer and winter, comes about from national teams attending those sort of events.
And so what's the benchmark in terms of, you know, bang for your buck, if you like? Is it that Australian teams compete more effectively, that we win more Olympic medals, that we break more world records?
Well, in fact, I have been asked sort of, you know, in the longer term, aren't we in fact going to lose our competitive advantage? We're only a small country. It's not going to be a race to outspend each other, because we couldn't compete in that sort of environment. So what's our competitive advantage? And it's twofold. One is that we have a great national sporting system built around clubs and volunteerism, and you get a leverage effect that's pretty well not evident in most countries around the world. So the strength of our club system and the way it's been built up over the last 100 years is a great pillar of our continued international success. The other thing is that we're actually smarter. We would say we're smarter. We have a considerable track record in terms of doing things smart, from understanding how a sporting system works and providing technology and research to support our sports, to support our coaches, to support our athletes. So I would say that those two particular competitive advantage pillars are not ones that will be eroded over time.
And,
Sorry.
No, that's right. Do you think this allocation of $12.6 million will be controversial, given the context that many listeners would be aware that at the moment the Australian National Academy of Music is facing closure because of a lack of funds? Now, I know that the Minister, Peter Garrett, is in negotiation with ANAM, but to many people, those young musicians and performers are, if you like, the Olympians of the arts. They're sort of like the young sports people at the AIS. Do you think it's controversial that elite sport gets more funding when elite art seems to be suffering?
I think it's good to make a comparison in terms of the passion, the talent, the drive of both our young artists and our young athletes. Because in fact, there's a lot of crossover there. In fact, we've run programs that have blended the two groups together, and they're very much leveraged off each other. But in terms of, I suppose, government support of those two sectors, then there will be differences of opinion. But I would say, coming from the sports side, is, you know, you need to, I think, fully appreciate the value of what sport brings, you know, and it is about national identity and national pride and connectedness through our international success. But that's also bringing more people into the sporting system from the grassroots level. It's through basically sport, and I would say it really is probably the greatest social movement there is in terms of humankind. And it's probably also the most undersold, because it has these outcomes in terms of well-being for individuals. It is about also connectedness in communities, about social inclusion. It's about self-esteem. People tend to look at, I suppose, the back seven pages of the tabloid press, and they see some fairly not the best stories, and, you know, and they've got to be dealt with, and there will always be that sense of controversy. But what's going on in Australia, sort of week in, week out, is in fact the delivery of sport that is to the benefit of all Australians. As I say, from a health point of view, a community point of view. And I can point to a number of our programs or a number of sports that are doing fantastic things for the public good of Australia and Australians.
Indeed, I can concur with much of what you said, but I am also aware of comments such as that of Tessa Jowell, the British minister responsible for the 2012 Olympics. And she made a comment that I saw reported in the Australian press that had she known about the impact of the financial crisis we're all now experiencing, that might have given pause to the people behind the 2012 London Olympics. Do you, Brent, think that we need to rethink elite sport? Is it simply sucking up too much money for the value that it provides? And I do acknowledge those generalised benefits that it provides.
Look, I think the financial global meltdown is quite extraordinary. I mean, on a personal level, I'd say I probably wouldn't have sort of looked at some investments I've made if I had have known what was coming up. So certainly in all sectors, people are looking at what the impact of this financial crisis will mean. And it may well have been that with sort of evidence of this being on the horizon, that a different approach might have been taken in this particular instance in terms of the UK hosting the London Olympics. But, you know, the question really, I suppose, what you're saying is that has it become too expensive? Well, the question of two is one that you need to look at very carefully, but you do need to acknowledge that elite sport is expensive. It is very, very expensive. And for us, even more so, as I say, particularly in terms of that need for international travel. So it is expensive, and it is a question of making sure that your investment does return the maximum benefits. Too expensive? Well, I mean, it'll be difficult for all sectors, but I would hope that, as I've mentioned, and you've acknowledged to some extent, that the benefits that sport provide in the longer term, you know, are recognised as something that you would obviously be putting some of those outcomes at risk if there was to be a significant wind back in terms of level of support. So, yeah, look, it's extraordinary times, and obviously things need to be looked at very, very carefully. And indeed, that's what the review by David Crawford is doing. It really is saying, well, we're actually coming off the back of some pretty good results, but there are some trends internationally and also culturally within Australia, generational change. So we're looking at all those things and saying, well, what does the future look like? And in that context, certainly in terms of any consideration by a government, then they have to take into account the overall financial situation. But, you know, I think the case for sport is very strong in terms of the public good.
Brent Esplan, thank you very much for being on The Sports Factor.
Thank you.
The Acting Chief of the Australian Sports Commission, Brent Esplan. Now to a more formal economic analysis of the capacity of government to allocate money to sport, specifically elite sport, during a time of economic contraction. Dr. Mark Stewart is a senior lecturer in the School of Economics, Finance and Marketing at the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology, RMIT.
The federal government is oscillating between thinking, oh, well, we're going to have less revenue because the economy is slowing, so less tax revenue is being collected. So we're going to have to wind back on spending, and sport, of course, is one of the things that they spend money on. Alternatively, they're concerned that if they wind back on spending, they're going to miss out on stimulating a slowing economy. So they're not quite sure, I think. I mean, they've sort of jumped between one and the other. So if there is a drive to wind back on government spending, then it's very likely that sport could be something hit. Whereas if they are inclined to keep government spending up, sport may well survive. So I'm not quite sure, and I don't think they are quite sure at the moment either.
Indeed, it doesn't seem to me to have been the sort of priority in the Rudd government that, say, in the Howard administration, there was a sense that, you know, John Howard was someone who would fly the flag in sporting terms. You know, he'd wear a Wallabies tracksuit or wear a, you know, a Socceroos tracksuit, you know, whatever the occasion demanded. And there was a sense that he saw sport as something to support. Do you get the sense that the Labor government has that same priority?
I think you're right. John Howard, I mean, we know he was a genuine sports fan. You only had to hear him talk about it. You can work that out pretty quickly. Kevin Rudd doesn't give me the same feeling when he talks about sport. And the fact that, as far as I could see, there was absolutely nothing in his 2020 summit relating to sport gives me that feeling that he may not personally have the same sort of inclination. Now, there certainly are other people in his government who would be inclined to fund sport, and there may be other reasons for doing so as well. But I think you've hit the nail on the head. I'm being someone involved in sport and sports funding, I'm a little concerned.
Indeed. Now, just on that 2020 summit, did that surprise you that given the sort of at least superficial significance that sport has in Australia, that it didn't become a topic?
I think so. I mean, there was quite a lot of people from the arts and different things like that, film, music, all these sorts of things, but I don't think there was anything from sport. I mean, as I said, it was quite a concern.
The notion of funding sport publicly. Now, when I've spoken to you before, you've spoken to me about the difference between, in economic terms, between public good and private good, and I think that's an interesting argument. Could I get you to elaborate how sports funding fits into that sort of economic paradigm?
Normally, we can justify spending money on... A government can justify spending money on things if they're classed as a public good. Now, a public good is a narrowly defined thing. Two contrasting things, a public good and a private good. A private good is something that where there is excludability in its consumption. For example, if I consume an apple, nobody else can jointly consume that apple. A public good is something where if I'm consuming it, it's not diminished. Now, the classic one is national defence. If you and I are living in Australia, it's being defended by our army. We're both consuming it equally. We're not diminishing, you know, the fact that we're both consuming together, it's not being diminished. Now, there are arguments that funding of sport has public good elements. In particular, if we enjoy watching an Australian win a gold medal and standing on the victory dais and crying as the national anthem is being played, everybody else in Australia is able to enjoy that as well. Now, if we then ask the public, should Australia, you know, fund its sports people better and win more medals, most people would say yes. Whereas if we said to them, well, would you like to personally contribute to the funding of this, they're probably less inclined to say yes, because they know that if someone pays for it, they can enjoy those benefits equally. So it's what in economics is termed a free rider problem. And so if there's some notion of demand that people want Australians to win but are not prepared to pay for it, then the only way for it to be paid for is for the money to be seized from the public in the form of taxation involuntarily and then spent on sport, as we do for many other things, as, you know, defence, health, education, these sorts of things. So that's one argument that has been put about, and I think there probably is something in that. The Sports Commission also argues that there are benefits in terms of health of the nation. Australia is a country where we spend a fortune on public health. If it can be argued that Australians doing well internationally results in more Australians getting out there and playing sport themselves, therefore becoming healthier, therefore being less inclined to draw on the public health system in terms of medical expenses, that can also be put about. But I'm not quite sure of the validity of that one. One of the problems with that argument is that although you may be more healthy when you play sport, you tend to hurt yourself as well and get injured. So I observe an awful lot of sports medical clinics around the place, and I'm sure they're all making a fair bit of money, and a large proportion of that is coming from the public purse. So it's perhaps a little more difficult to make that argument, but certainly the public good argument is something that may hold some water.
Mark, what about the idea of elite sport being funded? Because when we touch on this topic on this program, we regularly get emails or calls to say that people are happy for funding that takes on childhood obesity or national health campaigns. What they're not so interested in is shelling out millions of dollars so our rowers can win more gold medals or that we can get a cycling team into the top three in the world. Do you think as this financial crisis deepens, that criticism of elite sport will sharpen?
I suppose it will, but there's actually not that much money going towards elite sport in the overall scheme of things. The Australian Sports Commission is the government arm which is charged with funding elite sport. They have a budget of something between $150 million to $200 million a year. That might sound like a lot of money, but the Commonwealth government budget is more than $100 billion, and the state governments combined is that much again. So you're only talking about a very small fraction of a percent in terms of going to those things. Now, you know, if you've got a crisis and you think we should cut this money out, well, even if you cut it to zero, it's not going to make much difference to the government bottom line. There's been, of course, a push to try and increase that money of late, especially given the English have beaten us and won more medals than us at the last Olympic Games.
The horror, yeah.
You've heard John Coates arguing this clearly. I mean, he's from the Australian Olympic Committee. I mean, he's got a very strong interest in ensuring that Australia wins more medals, and he knows that money leads to medals. The problem, of course, for us is that you've got to keep spending more money to stand still, given that all the other countries are spending more money at the same time. And really, the English they've adopted our model. I mean, Australia worked out how to win more medals at the Olympic Games by funding what were traditionally amateur sports. So, you use government money to make an amateur sport into a professional sport, like track cycling or rowing or sailing or these sorts of things. And all of a sudden you win more medals. And that's exactly what's happened with the English. The English winning of medals at the last Olympics, the only difference between what they won in Beijing compared to what they won in Athens was that they won a whole lot more medals in track cycling and they won a whole lot more medals in sailing, which is where Australia has done well by using this model. You could spend a lot more money on road cycling or something like that, but you're probably not going to do all that much better, because if you give Cadell Evans another $1 million, he's not going to ride any harder. So, you know, that's the trick that they've done. So in terms of elite funding, I can't see how they're going to make all that much difference.
Mark, just on Cadell Evans, who you mentioned there. Now, obviously, Cadell Evans is the first Australian, I think, to be on the podium at the end of the Tour de France. He finished second in the overall in the general classification. He's someone who, obviously, because he rides in a prominent team, attracts huge sponsorship. Is the better argument for those elite sports that they should have to go out and find commercial sponsorship in the way that rugby league teams do or soccer teams do, that if people want to put their dollars on the table for sport because they're going to get access to lots of consumers, then that's good, but government should withdraw?
Oh, I think the best argument really is to try and set up a system for sport funding which is similar to the HECS funding that we have for university places, whereby you can sign up to become part of the Victorian Institute of Sport or the Australian Institute of Sport or something like this, but you need to take out some sort of HECS loan. And if you do make a lot of money, that can be used to generate the system, to keep the system going. I mean, I really think that's the only way we can keep proceeding, given the governments are going to be less inclined to spend a lot more money. If we could do that, then all of a sudden I reckon we could probably beat the Poms again without necessarily spending massive amounts of money. I mean, the English have done it by using running great big lotteries to fund their elite sports programs. So, yeah, I think that would be the way to go. I mean, some sports money, and most don't, and most sports people don't as well. But, you know, if you had a HECS sort of process where, you know, you make a certain amount of money and it goes to keep the system going, then you might be able to keep us up the medal table and all those sorts of things.
Absolutely. But what I was going back to interrupt and say then, does it make a big difference that it has to be only, say, the Leighton Hewitts of the world, just to pick on him for a moment, that people who go on, who have some sort of Australian Institute of Sport training or Sports Commission training, and then go on to make considerable money in their professional sport, they're the ones who are then obliged to pay back, that there is some cut-off? Because I imagine there are a lot of people, like there are a lot of actors, for example, who spend a lot of time waiting on tables and never get that big break, never become wealthy for treading the boards. But in a similar way, I imagine there are lots of sports people who don't go on to the high earning end. We're not asking them to pay back, are we? We're asking successful people to pay back.
As an economist, I don't actually think there's anything wrong with asking them to sign up to a HEC system, because a HEC system means that you're only paying back in relation to, you know, a 1%, 2% or something of your income tax returns. So, you know, Leighton Hewitt, if you win one tournament, you pay the whole lot back. Some other person, it's just being deducted like it is everybody else. If we spend money on someone, and if you make, I can't see why there's a major problem with doing that sort of thing. Now, that would be my view. Others may have a different view, but that's what I would say.
A final question, Mark Stewart, and it's to make you come out of your sporting comfort zone and look at another, and I think related issue this week, and that's the threat to the funding of the Australian National Academy of Music, ANAM. Now, for elite musicians and performers, this is a little bit like going to the AIS. In fact, I think a former arts minister, Rod Kemp, in the coalition government sort of sold the idea to John Howard, because it was initially a Keating Creative Nation initiative to set up ANAM. Now, Peter Garrett, the arts minister, is in the middle of negotiations about the $30 million over 12 years that taxpayers have funded the National Music Academy. It's facing the finalising of that subsidy and closure. Do you think all the principles that apply to sports funding should apply to that arts funding?
I think completely that should be the case. The arts, if you can make a public good argument that we feel good about having Australians who are considered world leaders and all of those sorts of things, that's really the only way you can justify it. I mean, people in the arts can, of course, make money as well, just like a sports person can, if they people are prepared to buy tickets to go and watch them play or act or sing or whatever it is. So it's hard for people to argue that sports funding should be cut if they don't also cut funding for the arts and those sorts of things.
Dr. Mark Stewart from RMIT. I'm Mick O'Regan, and this is The Sports Factor on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and online at abc.net.au/rn.
It's going to provide a platform for players, I guess, younger players to strive, something to strive for, and something to keep us players in Australia, because at the moment we're looking at, you know, a few ventures overseas now, and this definitely can grow, you know, big enough to actually attract some players from overseas. So it's going to do a number of things. We've needed this league for a while now, and it's been a long time coming.
Well, I think for us to have a week-in, week-out female competition against, you know, the other Matildas is going to make it so much better for our game, like, in a whole. At the moment, most of us are sort of playing against 15-year-old boys, and that's how we get our competition. And while it's challenging for us, it's nothing like playing against other females. So for us, it's just going to boost the strength of the game, I think, in Australia. And also, I think, hopefully help to keep lifting the profile. I think after the World Cup, we did quite well. And this will be the next step to kind of keep the game out there and keep girls wanting to be involved.
The sound of the sporting future. Women's football, yes, I realise many of you still call it soccer, is booming. In fact, it's arguably the fastest growing sport in the country. And emblematic of the youth and enthusiasm of women's football is the 20-year-old captain of the Central Coast Mariners in the W League, Caitlin Cooper. Hers is a great story of the talented youngster who earned her footballing spurs playing against boys, something that suited her dynamic style of play, and which she now attributes to her unyielding defence.
I've always been a kind of strong girl, so all the boys are always wondering why I push them off the ball and I give it back to them. Like, I don't care if they're boys, or I suppose they didn't care if I was a girl either. So it's fantastic being able to play with boys.
Tell me about the mentality that accompanies girls and boys sport. For you to be a bit aggressive at the ball and a hard player, which is what I'm hearing you say, was that encouraged by your coaches, or did they think that was inappropriate?
Very encouraged. I think that's one of my strengths, like why I'm a defender now. I was a midfield player, and now I'm a defender, and I think that's one of my greatest strengths, about being strong on the ball. And to increase our strength, we do gym work and so on, so we can push those, like, Chinese off the ball. Because in the States and stuff, they're a lot stronger than the Aussie girls.
But I'm really interested in the development of your skills. So when you were playing in the under-17s, were you targeted by coaching staff or by talent scouts as a young girl who had a serious future in football?
I did have a say in it in some aspects, but the coach approached my family because I was so young, and from there, like, it's all my decision now, and I've just been working hard at it. And again, going back to playing with boys, with our N-Swiss program, we're not actually allowed to play in a women's comp because they think it's unfair or whatever. So we're actually in the Boys Premier League in the winter months. We were playing against boys, like, every week in, week out. So that increases our skill, and because they're just so much quicker than us, and we won't improve playing with girls at a local level, so that's why we're in the boys' comp, so it's great with that.
Now, you're of the generation, Caitlin, where young women playing football or soccer in Australia really have role models. There's now obviously the W League, the Women's League in Australia, but there's also much higher profile for soccer generally. That, you know, the Socceroos made the 2006 World Cup finals in Germany, obviously. The Matildas have played very well. How important is it for you as a young woman playing football to have those role models, to see the code really progress in Australia?
It's fantastic. One of my greatest role models is, you obviously know, Cheryl Salisbury. I've been around her for many years now, and the way she conducts herself on and off the field is just amazing. And like you said, women's soccer is growing faster and faster each year, and with this new W League, it's just great for younger and older people to get their foot in the door and for us to actually be competitive on the world stage. That's the ultimate goal, like women's soccer to be up there, 1-2 in the world. That for now we're, I think, 15th in the world for the women, and we want to get higher and higher. So having role models like Cheryl to kind of push us and get us going, it's just fantastic.
Right, now Cheryl Salisbury is a central defender in the Matildas. Now that's the role you have with the Central Coast Mariners, isn't it?
Yep.
So in that back four, your centre field in that back four, basically the last line of defence in front of the goalkeeper.
Yeah, that's correct.
So what elements of Cheryl's game do you seek to copy, to emulate?
Her communication skills. Like, I'm getting there, but I think I can, like, you can always improve, obviously, but she can just pick a team up when they're all down, and, like, that's some skills I need to learn about, and I admire her with those skills. It's just fantastic.
What do you think leading footballers have to do off-field? What's your sense of the role model that you're becoming?
I don't want to be front page of the paper with, like, the rugby league. I shouldn't use that an example, but I think you have to be very approachable for starters. Like, you have to watch what you do wherever you are. We're not as known as the men, but we're getting there, and you don't want, like, women's soccer to be putting a bad word on women's soccer for the way you act around. Do you get me? Like, around,
I do, absolutely.
Yeah,
indeed.
When you're out in public.
So I mean, and your generation is the generation that's going to take women's football to that next level. Now I want to ask you about being the captain of the Central Coast Mariners. I can hear in your voice your youth, and I have met you, so I know that you are a young woman. Is it a big responsibility to be very young and to be the captain of a W League team?
When I was appointed the actual captaincy, like, there's girls that are 32 in my team, and, like, I'm only 20. Like, it's really hard to... I think the reason why I got the captaincy, because I'm very approachable. I can talk to the girls whenever, like, about anything. It's just fantastic to captain the girls, and all ages. There's girls 16 in my team and there's girls 32 in my team, so it's great.
Can there be any doubt that one day she'll play for Australia? Caitlin Cooper, captain of the Central Coast Mariners in the W League. And that's it for the Sports Factor for this week. Now, for those of you who tuned in order to hear the conversation with Shane Gould, well, it'll be on next week's Sports Factor, I promise. What a fascinating person Shane Gould is. For many people, she simply disappeared. Well, she did quit elite swimming earlier than some officials had hoped, but she's gone on to live a rich and diverse life, which has had a commitment to movement and exercise as a continuous element. Shane Gould, next week on The Sports Factor. Thanks to the team of producer Andrew Davies, technical producer Jim Usher, and to the tireless Sabrina Lipovich in ABC Radio Archives. Any questions you have regarding downloading the audio, listening online, or reading a transcript of the show can be answered by going to our webpage, abc.net.au sportsfactor.com.au/rn/sportsfactor. I'm Mick O'Regan. Thanks for listening. I hope you'll join me at the same time next week for another edition of The Sports Factor here on ABC Radio National.
In the not-too-distant future, warfare is the basis of the global economy. And technology has created a new kind of military.
Movie trailers can be cliched, and occasionally they're even better than the films they promote. But when they work, they can really boost a film's box office. We'll find out why on the Media Report. Download or stream this program from the Radio National website.